From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Long before the first Irish men and women escaped a potato famine, before the train du Canada brought tens of thousands of French Canadians across our borders, before boatloads of Eastern Europeans arrived in New Hampshire, there was David Thompson. He was a Scotsman and an entrepreneur who, along with his family and a few servants, set up a fishing village at what is now O'Diorne Point, outside of Portsmouth. Thompson could be considered New Hampshire's first immigrant who came from another country in search of a better life and decided to make the Granite State his new home. After Thompson, more settlers followed, mostly from southwest England. And when they did, those who were already living in what would become New Hampshire, the Native Americans, were none too happy about it. Their lands taken, their way of life destroyed. Since those early times, new people from new lands came to call the Granite State home. Irish and Swedish, Italians, Lithuanians, and more recently, Burundians, Iraqis, Somalis, Burmese, and Bhutanese. Each group of new arrivals has brought something new to the state, adding to its culture, economy, and industry, and sometimes finding themselves involved in new conflicts with groups of established residents. Since July, NHBR has been looking at the issue of immigration as part of a 9-month series called New Hampshire's Immigration Story. But this week, we really kick it off, and today we start with a look at New Hampshire's long history of immigration. We begin with Exchange Executive Producer Keith Shields. He's leading NHPR's effort on this. And Keith, nice to see you on this side of the microphone.
Very nice to be here, Laura.
Well, when we think of immigration, Keith, you know, we think of Florida, Arizona, Texas. What about New Hampshire? It doesn't seem like this is a state that has a big immigration story to tell.
Well, you know, Laura, I kind of thought the same thing when I was presented with this project. You know, I'm from a very, at least, racially diverse area of New Jersey. And, you know, New Hampshire is one of the more, at least, racially heterogeneous states. And I thought, well, how compelling of a history could this possibly be? But I started to look at it. I mean, unless you're full-blooded Native American, you at some point in time or someone in your family landed on American soil. And sometimes that soil was New Hampshire soil. Sometimes the first establishment in your family was in New Hampshire. So it was different people. It was the French. It was the Irish, as you said. It was the Greeks and the Lithuanians. It's the newer groups today. You know, I found at one point in time, then back around 1900, New Hampshire was ranked sixth overall in foreign-born residents.
Wow.
Yeah, and compared nationally at that time is about 30%, and New Hampshire was 40%. So we really do have a big history, and I'm really looking forward to exploring that.
Well, what were some of the themes that you discovered, Keith, as you were looking into this? You know, even though we're just kind of really kicking this off today, you've been looking into this for a long time.
Exactly, and I don't want to take too much fire away from our guest today talking about the history, but there are a lot of things that keep on reoccurring. The economy, for example, and its influence on immigration. Sometimes there were people standing at Ellis Island wanting to drag people to New Hampshire to work in the mills, to work with specific things that they were specialized in, whether it was lace making or granite cutting.
So recruiters.
Recruiting. People saying, please come to New Hampshire from your country. Other times, you know, they've been an economic burden. At least some people have thought of them as an economic burden. There's many other things. I mean, you think about the office and the new person who comes into the office. I mean, sometimes there are people who think, oh, wow, this person's going to lighten my load. This person's going to add something new. And then the other times there's a little fear around this person. What is this person going to bring? Are they going to have different habits? Are they going to be mean? Are they going to drag me down? So are they going to take away my job? So it really these things keep reoccurring. And there was one particular thing that I found with this idea about the French-Canadian experience that we're going to be talking about today and how it's related to the Mexican-American experience. And what they have in common is this shared border with the United States. So it's a different story I've learned, you know, because there is this to and from migration that happens all along, and it creates new conflicts that between the older establishment and the newer establishment.
Well, Keith, what do you hope we all learn from this? I mean, there's so many shows we have, not just this week, but in the coming months. What might be the takeaway when all is said and done?
I would say, I mean, there's so much we can take away from this. I mean, we have 9 months to do this. I would say two things. I think the issue of immigration is nuanced. It's very much not black and white. And so I think sometimes it's made to be black and white. It's either you're for or against it. You know, they're either a liability or they bring a lot to it. We should embrace them open arms or we should not at all. And I think that, you know, each group that comes in brings in something new. And then they also bring in their own challenges, whether it's a language barrier career. Maybe it's a skill set that they don't have or a skill set that they do have. You know, and I think the other thing is just to think about immigration. And, you know, we all have someone from a different country, you know, who came over here. As I said, I grew up in a very first generation neighborhood. My father was from another country. You know, I never asked him why he came over here. I don't know how much of a struggle he had. I don't know if my best friend, who was Dominican at the time, why his family came over here. So it's, it'd be great to explore that, to ask those questions, just think about that more, and that's what I hope we do.
How is this going to proceed, Keith, both on the radio, and there's a big component on the website, right?
Right. There's 9 months. I mean, we've done great series on food and long-term care and alternative energy, and we've had a week to do it, and we've been able to accomplish a lot. Now we have 9 months, and so there's going to be a lot of shows on the exchange. Lots of stories in the news department and word of mouth. I'm going to be following a Bhutanese refugee family for an entire year. We're going to bring back the Socrates Exchange in the spring and ask the question, what is an American? And we're going to have a great web presence. Courtney Kenny is working on that, and it's going to have lots of maps and charts and wonderful things like that are going to complement the series.
Well, it's going to be fun.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Keith Shields. Again, he's the executive producer of The Exchange and coordinator of this series on New Hampshire's immigration story. Let's hear from you this hour as we kick off the major portion of this series as we look at New Hampshire's immigration story. Did you or a parent or a grandparent emigrate to New Hampshire from another country? Why did you or your relatives come? Where did your family settle? What were the challenges? And do you think they're similar to the challenges and experiences that other groups have faced or not? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. With us in studio is Stu Wallace, New Hampshire historian, professor at NHTI, Concord's Community College. And Stu, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Also with us, David Waters, professor of English at UNH, where he's the director of the Center for New England Culture. David's also project advisor to our immigration series. And David, nice to see you too. Thanks.
Good morning, Laura. Nice to be here.
Well, and gentlemen, before we get into all the many peoples who came here and their experiences, Dave, just remind us briefly about the first people to immigrate to New Hampshire and who was here when they arrived.
Well, New Hampshire was home to a large Native American population, maybe 15,000, concentrated along the main rivers and along the coast. And then we had very early on English immigrants, and as we heard, Scotch as well, coming into the Portsmouth and Dover areas. And I think that, you know, it's that kind of mixing from the very, very beginning. It was primarily English. You know, New Hampshire is one of the most English of the New England states up until the 1840s and 1850s. And that's the tradition that came in and started, you know, the linen industry. The Scotch-Irish is famous for that, but mostly an agricultural state with some shipbuilding and manufacturing along the coast.
Well, and next week, on the day before Thanksgiving, we'll talk in a lot more detail about those first immigrants that you mentioned, David, the English, the Scottish, and that first meeting of cultures between the natives and the first white settlers. So we'll get into that more later. I do want to touch on with both of you the big themes that Keith just mentioned that we see again and again as immigration story. And Stu Wallace, if you could just add on to those themes and flesh them out a little more for us with some examples.
Well, actually, the easiest way to look at it is the way Oscar Hanlon did it, the great immigration historian. He said, "I once wanted to write about immigration in America and discovered that immigration is American history." We're all from somewhere else, most of us, and that it is a process that has been going on since David Thompson got here to New Hampshire, and it is a process that has – it comes in waves. We like to think of waves as immigrants somehow coming onto our shores, even though larger numbers came by way of France and Mexico or Puerto Rico or elsewhere. But we've had waves of immigrants that have continually come over here. And we've had waves of nativism that comes along with it, the idea that we may want the immigrant to work for us, we may want the immigrant to enrich our lives, but we don't necessarily like the immigrant as an individual or a person or by virtue of their differences.
Wow. Give us an example, Stu.
Well, the classic example would have been in the 1840s. We went through a period of time when we didn't have much beyond English and Scottish here until the late 1840s. In the 1840s, we started to have Irish and Germans coming in large numbers. And at a place like Manchester, they had major riots whereby the Protestants would rush into Catholic neighborhoods, and they would be stirred up by the likes of Ned Buntline and other foreigners who'd come in here and tell us about the dangers of what they used to call race suicide. Probably should be ethnic suicide. But we had major riots in Manchester for a while, an effort to somehow, I don't know what they thought they were going to do, push back the immigrant to throw them back into the ocean, which is not going to happen.
Well, so we've seen these clashes and culture conflicts before. This is nothing new.
No, we've seen it several times.
What do you think, David?
Well, I think another big period of that was, you know, in the 1890s and early 1900s. Of course, 23 million immigrants came in through Ellis Island from 1880 to 1920. And there was a movement called Anglo-Saxonism to say that here we were diluting the race. The Ku Klux Klan was part of that. It was big in Rye, New Hampshire, and Nashua, New Hampshire. It was attacked particularly African-Americans, of course, but in New England it was Jews and other non-Christians. And the Anti-Immigration League started in 1894 and said that we have to, you know, protect America from these hordes. Thomas Bailey Aldrich of Story of a Bad Boy fame in Portsmouth looked over his back fence and saw the Russians and the Poles and the Italians and said, you know, we have unguarded gates, that the white goddess of liberty shouldn't shut these, let these Slavs and Jews come in. Now, the Irish and the French Canadians said, wait a minute, you know, we're about a third of the population of the state, and we're Celts and we're Teutons. And so we have to tell these Anglo-Saxons that that's not all that made up what America is.
Well, and Keith talked about the economics and recruiters going to Ellis Island to say to people, please come to New Hampshire to work in our factories and our mills. David, is that the main reason why most people come to New Hampshire, economic, or is there something else?
Oh, certainly economic engine is there. In the 19th century, it was the Amiskeg. You know, it can be a generalized term. That's Manchester. But you think about Dover, Somersworth, Rochester, particularly textile productions. And, you know, 50% of the spin room in Amiskeg was French. And then you had 10% Pole. And then you had 10% Scotch. And so there'd be some specialization. You know, Finns came in, Lithuanians came into lace, and the dyers were Scotch. So,
all right. And we'll hear more after a short break, David. Thank you. So stay with us.
Support for NHPR comes from You, Our Members, and Monadnock Live Free and Equal Coalition, presenting a talk by Charlene Strong, Civil Rights, Equal Rights, Marriage Equality, this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Keene State College Student Union. From the Common Man family, celebrating 40 years of uncommon hospitality and community commitment to New Hampshire. Information about 40th anniversary events at theseaman.com. And from Sovereignet Communications, a telephone and internet provider whose mission includes supporting local communities, including the Vermont and New Hampshire food banks. New Hampshire weather for today, partly to mostly cloudy with some scattered rain showers, highs 55 to 60. For tonight, cloudy with scattered rain showers, lows 47 to 52. For tomorrow, any showers should come to an end, staying partly to mostly cloudy, highs from 52 north ranging to 62 in southern parts of the state. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the history of immigration as part of NHPR's year-long series on New Hampshire's immigration story. Our guests for the hour are David Waters, professor of English at UNH, project advisor to our series, and Stu Wallace, New Hampshire historian, professor at NHTI, Concord's Community College. Let's hear from you, too. What's your family's immigration story? How and when and why did your family come to New Hampshire? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us exchange@nhpr.org. And David Waters, sorry I had to cut you off there going into the break. We were talking about largely the economic engine of the mills that brought people to New Hampshire. You were talking about the specialization of different peoples in the mills and all the different cultures and languages that were there.
Well, mills knew they needed particular skills. So, you know, Germans who might be loom fixers or machinists, they'd be recruited to come in and do those jobs. The Scotch were known for their work in a dye houses. Another factor on the economic side, too, was that some groups would come in kind of at the end of the chain, like the Greeks come in, and they don't want just the menial jobs in the mills. And the French are going to, and the Irish are going to insist they don't be more than 10% of the labor force. So they quickly go into entrepreneurial activity, into food services. It's like Michael Dukakis said in his presidential campaign, you want to find the Greeks, go into the kitchen of the pizza parlors. And that's,
wow,
that was true. Or when the Jews came in, also they didn't want to be at the bottom of the line for the mills. So they quickly started to move into the clothing trades, became peddlers. In New Hampshire, moved into the junk business, and particularly in Portsmouth, the story of the Shapiro family. And they found, you know, economic entrepreneurial activities, which really meant the kind of growth of the small businesses in New Hampshire.
You know, what's so interesting, David, about what you say is that the companies, you know, today, I don't know if people would do this, but the company said, okay, you're Irish, so you're good at this, and you're Swedish, so you're good at this. Today, we would say, well, everybody has talents and skills. But back then, they kind of generalized and put people in positions based on where they were from.
Well, it also depended on your English skills. If you spoke English, they used to call the Americans, the second generation Irish, and of course the Scotch and the English. But then the un-Americans, or the non-Americans, were the ones like the French and the Greeks and the Russians who needed translators. And they had a harder time because they had to go through translators to get better paying jobs. There is still some today, though, of economic specialization. Think of South Asians. Almost 50% of South Asians who've come into New Hampshire the last 20 years are in professional or administrative jobs, and about 50% are in technical sales and managerial. So that, you know, is a pretty large group, about 18,000 of the last census who have come in because they have a particular set of skills, whether they're, you know, in the medical or hotel management. And so we still see that New Hampshire, because it's such a diverse economy and with a high-tech economy, still draws immigrants into certain fields.
It's economics, of course, Stu, but there's more to it than that, right? Why people choose to come here.
Well, first of all, you have to take a look at why people chose to leave their country of origin, and that has a lot to do with what comes here. Economics has a lot to do with why people left, say, Quebec. Economics has a lot to do with why people left places like Italy. They were forced to come here by virtue of the fact they had really no other good choice at home, and so they took the chance. They came here. And as a result of that, we often took that rationale for coming here and turned it into stereotypes. And we do stereotype immigrant groups. When I was a kid growing up in the New York area, we never said laundry. We said Chinese laundry.
Really?
Yeah, because it was just assumed that the Chinese did the laundry. Actually, I never knew a single Chinese who did laundry, but it was a stereotype we had developed over time. We had developed stereotypes about the food business. A lot of immigrant groups will find their way into the core culture through food. It's a universal thing. We have to eat. It used to be a bad joke about Greeks that I've noticed was repeated in Peyton Place, of all things. What happens when two Greeks meet? They start a restaurant. And so these stereotypes will develop over time. Italians in the north end of Concord came here as stonecutters. But after a couple of miserable cold winters in the quarries, they got into the food distribution business, starting out with carts and later going into small supermarkets. And in the 1950s, supermarkets in so-called our food markets in Concord were actually little Italian markets and little tiny stores. It was a step up from the food carts. And so part of the rationale here, the stereotyping, has to do with why they came. They were forced in many cases. In other cases, they were actively recruited. Scandinavians and Russians recruited in Berlin because they could work in cold climates. Italians as stonecutters. So there's a push-pull. You have to look at where they're coming from and why they came, and then what happens when they get here.
Well, and there's also the idea that once there's a couple folks here, it's a lot easier for the family and the friends and so forth to follow along.
Word of mouth is not only important, and sometimes it's more than that, because when we started to have literacy tests, you had to have somebody competent in literate in your language. But that loophole, there was a loophole which allowed you then to bring your family over. And so you
some of
could,
these families are pretty big.
Right, so you could pass your literacy test if you had somebody in the family who knew the language and could pass the literacy test, and then you brought over the family.
And you can define family broadly.
You
my
could,
second
that,
and third
you
and
could,
fourth
so you
cousins,
could bring the,
wife,
all sorts
brother.
Of family members.
Right. Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHBR. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire's large and diverse immigration history, and let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Well, gentlemen, as we've been talking about, the French Canadians, of course, play a huge role in this story. All over the state, especially, though, in Manchester with the Emmisgeg Mills that you mentioned, David. Exchange executive producer Keith Shields brings us now the story of one such immigrant whose story exemplifies that of many others.
You've probably never heard of the name Philip LeMay. After all, his life wasn't that significant. LeMay was one of tens of thousands of French-Canadian immigrants who came to New Hampshire a century ago to work in its large textile mills. But in the late 1930s, the Federal Writers Project, part of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, employed writers to collect histories of average Americans across the country. And number 1801 was called French-Canadian Textile Worker, as told by Philip LeMay.
I'm going to tell you as well as I can the story of the French-Canadian textile worker. What brought him here? How he came, lived, worked, played, and suffered until he was recognized as a patriotic, useful, and respected citizen. The picture of one French-Canadian textile worker and the picture of another are just as much alike as, well, as we have learned to say in English, like two peas in a pod.
Well, he gives us a beautiful narrative.
Robert Macheski is an associate professor at the University of New Hampshire in Manchester who specializes in immigration and labor history.
It's very difficult to find workers' voices, to be honest. The lower you go down the social ladder, the fewer remnants in history that people find. He's providing really a major history, not just of the mills, but of the French-Canadian community.
Philip LeMay was born in Saint-Ephraim-d'Epton in the province of Quebec in 1856. At the age of 8, he moved down with his family to Lowell, Massachusetts. And in 1872, he came to Manchester, New Hampshire to work at its Emmisgeg Mills. By the time he arrived, there were about 2,000 French Canadians living in the Queen City, and that number seemed to grow every single day. Robert Perot is a historian of New England Franco-American culture.
In 72, you've already got a couple things that have happened. You've got a newspaper that was founded. They founded a parish, St. Augustine's Parish. There was a society, the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste, St. John the Baptist Society, which was like a fraternal, social-type society with insurance. There were so many people coming in every year. It was pretty evident that this was going to be something permanent.
Every day of the week, in summer as in winter, the working hours of mill hands were from 6 in the morning until 6 at night, and that schedule was continued for many years. Nobody complained because everybody was happy and contented. It was good to have a steady job and steady pay with the assurance that you didn't have to loaf until you wanted to.
Conditions were tough for the mill worker of LeMay's time. Long hours, hot and humid rooms, the air was saturated with dust, and industrial accidents were a part of work life. But French Canadians gained a reputation of being good workers who hardly ever complained, and because of this, recruiters sought them out to work in their mills. Once again, Robert Perot.
They were known as being industrious and docile. That was the way they were described. And so if you were a good worker, what could happen if you were intelligent enough to hone your skills, you could eventually rise up.
And that's what happened for LeMay. He was one of the first Franco-Americans to become an overseer at Emmisgeg, a decision that he says was a hard sell to the higher-ups of that time.
One day, I asked the super if he wouldn't give me the chance. He was so surprised that he couldn't speak for a long time. He was looking at me as if he had been struck by thunder and lightning. What? A Frenchman has the crust to think he could be an overseer. That was something unheard of, absolutely shocking. The next day, he came to me, and still with a doubting expression spread all over his face, he said he'd try me for 6 months. No 6 months for me, 1 month. That's all I wanted to show what I could do.
What Emmisgeg tended to do was they took people of certain ethnic groups, some of the earlier ethnic groups, and they would promote them that way so that they could control the people. In other words, if you take one of their countrymen who speaks the language and you promote that person can act as a go-between. The superintendent wants something. He'll tell that smaller boss who speaks the language and knows all his people and how they think and all that. And so they'll listen to their own countrymen. And to them, it's great because one of their people is a boss. So it looks as if, whoa, if I do a good job, I could perhaps one day become a boss as well.
In his long interview, Philip LeMay talks about the harsh conflicts between Irish and Franco-Americans, the music and dancing that emanated from the homes of mill workers after a long, hard work week, and the strike of 1922, which economically devastated Manchester. LeMay retired from the mills in 1924, and by the time he was interviewed in 1938, Manchester was a very different place. Amskeg had shut down several years before, while new businesses, many now run by second and third generation immigrants, were popping up all over Manchester. And the French Canadians were the dominant culture of the city, with their own churches, societies, schools, and even a string of Franco-American mayors. LeMay was witness to this 65-year history that completely transformed his city. And as he concludes his interview, he takes a step back to look with pride of the contributions that he and tens of thousands of other Franco-Americans have made to the city, state, and their country.
Now, the surviving French-Canadian textile workers of long ago, their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren have won the respect and esteem of their fellow citizens. Yes, we surely have found our place in the sun of American liberty. To what do we owe our success? I believe we owe it to the self-sacrificing French-Canadian immigrants from Old Quebec, to the courage that made them refuse to accept defeat and quit when that would have seemed the natural thing to do, to the cheerfulness that carried us through our trials and tribulations and helps us old-timers to wait happily for the final bell calling us home to rest after our long, hard life in the textile mills.
That piece again produced by Exchange Executive Producer Keith Shields, and thanks to our Philip LeMay reader, Mal Cameron. If you want the full WPA story on Philip LeMay, you can go to our website at nhpr.org. I want to bring another voice into our conversation now, Robert Perot, an historian and lecturer in Manchester history and New England Franco-American culture. He teaches French at St. Anselm College. And Robert, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, and we just heard that great story from Keith about Philip LeMay. And let's just continue this story for a bit, if we could, Robert. What's the legacy of these tens of thousands of French Canadians who came down from Quebec mostly to work in the mills and other industries in New Hampshire?
I think they changed the city, actually. They added the French language. They brought their food from Canada. They brought their traditions. Just about everything that we have today, that we live, the culture, it's all over. It's all over the place. But you know what? What's funny is there was a book that was published in Maine called Quiet Presence, and it's in our culture, but it's something that other cultures have to discover. And so we have, like, Chez Vachon, the restaurant Chez Vachon, which is very popular in Manchester. People will go there and eat, and they hear French spoken and meet French-speaking people. And so, but it's something that you have to go and discover. It's not something that's necessarily right out there, if you know what I mean. We have a very private culture. And yet, we've had mayors of Manchester who were Franco-Americans. We've had businesses. But when I speak with people in Manchester who aren't Franco-American and I give tours of the West Side, people have grown up side by side with Franco-Americans. They don't necessarily know what's going on. It's a whole discovery.
It's that quietness that you keep mentioning.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, and we were told that by the nuns. You know, the nuns used to tell us, you know, don't make waves. Other groups might make waves, but don't make waves. Just live your life the way, you just be good. Be good.
Very interesting. Well, how did the fact that these French Canadians who were so close to their home country change their story, Robert? Because, you know, if you're an immigrant from Ireland or Poland, once you're here, you're not going back. Probably not for a visit and definitely not to move back. But as I understand, there was a fair bit of back and forth. Not all French Canadians who came to New Hampshire to work stayed in New Hampshire.
Well, at the very beginning, that's exactly what was happening. As they were coming down, they were having economic problems on their farms, as well as political problems, because they were second-class citizens in their own country after the conquest. And so many were coming down to work in the mills and in the shoe shops and other industries just to make a little bit of money, and especially in the wintertime, because farms, you work on the farm in the summertime, but in the wintertime, you could go to the logging camps up way up north where it's cold, and or come down to the mills and work. So oftentimes you had young single men who would come down, make some money, and go back. But as time went on, they realized that life down here was much better because you had a guaranteed pay. You know, there was nothing guaranteed about farm life. You know, your animals could die, your crops could fail, and so the guarantee was down here. So little by little, it became a permanent migration.
And we heard in that piece, Robert, that how the mills shut down. So where did the many French-Canadian mill workers go then? What kind of jobs did they do?
Well, the mills in Manchester shut down not permanently. What happened was the Amiskeag Manufacturing Company shut down in in the fall of 1935, September 35, and then they tried to reorganize. They filed bankruptcy on Christmas Eve 1935. Then came the flood of 36, and that kind of closed everything out. So that at that point, Amiskeag Industries was founded by Arthur Moreau, who had been a former mayor of Manchester. He and a group of citizens in Manchester formed Amiskeag Industries, which bought up the entire mill yard and then resold it, part of it to the Public Service Company of New Hampshire and part of it to Diversified Industries. So as soon as 1936, 1937, 1938, already you had new industries coming in, like the Chicopee Manufacturing Company, the Wambeck Manufacturing Company. Those were textile mills, but some of the shoe shops also moved down into the mill yard, and new industries came in. The Habitant Pea Soup Company, which was founded by some Canadian immigrants here in Manchester, the Morin family. So you had all kinds of diversified industries so that no one company like Amiskeag could dominate the city's workforce.
Well, Robert, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us, both now and in the piece that we heard from Keith.
Thank you.
That's Robert Perreault, a historian and lecturer on Manchester history and New England Franco-American culture. He also teaches French at St. Anselm College. After a short break, we will start taking your calls. Again, we're looking at New Hampshire's immigration story. It's part of a year-long series on this. Today, we're really kicking off a big week of coverage with a look at the history of our immigration. Other pieces of this story will follow this week. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, and we'll be right back.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join me as I sit down with NPR's Guy Raz. He spent nearly a decade as a foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe and throughout the Middle East, and now hosts Weekends on All Things Considered. We'll discuss his transformation from reporter to host and take your questions. Join us at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont on November 15th. Visit nhpr.org to get your tickets.
Made possible with support from TransCanada.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and the attorneys at Orr & Reno Global Vision, New Hampshire Values. Trusted business advisors for entrepreneurs, business owners, and nonprofit corporations, orr-reno.com. And from Plymouth State University's College of Graduate Studies, enrolling now for winter term, which begins December 1st. Online registration at plymouth.edu/graduate. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our series on New Hampshire's immigration story continues as we look at how newcomers interact with the healthcare system. Email us your thoughts on that topic before the show to exchange@nhpr.org, and then be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're taking a broad look at the history of immigration in New Hampshire, and let's hear from you, too. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. If you or a grandparent or parent emigrated to New Hampshire from another country, why did you or your relatives come? Where did your family settle? What were some of the challenges? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And David Waters, Stu Wallace, let's go to our callers now. Ty's calling from Brookline. Hi, Ty. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning, taking this program. I am an immigrant from North Korea. Korea to South Korea, from South Korea to America.
Wow.
Now I am settled in New Hampshire, which I love very much.
And what brought you here, Ty?
Well, I think that the for education and opportunity, freedom.
Did you come to study college here in New Hampshire from South Korea and then just end up staying, Ty, or what happened?
From South Korea, I went to New York City. I worked almost 3 years, 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock midnight to save enough money to go to college. And I went to Brigham Young University for my undergraduate and graduate school in statistics. And I worked for Reader's Digest, AT&T, and a couple banks. And as I'm getting older, I decided to retire. I retired at 72. At 72, I moved to New Hampshire to be closer to my two children.
Well, Ty, welcome. And, you know, we should talk about, David, immigrants from Asia. This is also, you know, we tend to focus on the French-Canadian and Germans and Poles and Swedish as part of our history. But there's a major story here, too, with immigrants from Asia.
Well, Ty's story is particularly interesting about the ways that immigration patterns have changed, particularly after the Refugee Act of 1980. And New Hampshire has become so connected to international stories. You know, whether it's Uganda or the Bhutanese or the Indonesians, people who are granted refugee status because of civil wars in their own countries. And they come to New Hampshire in part because of Catholic charity services and other organizations, but also because of the opportunities that Ty mentioned. There's education, there's an entrepreneurial environment, housing is relatively inexpensive compared to the cities. I mean, for example, the Indonesians that are now coming into they have their churches in Portsmouth and in Dover and in Rochester. And so, you know, a very new place for them, but also maintaining some traditional interests that most of the laborers who worked at Tuttle's Farm, which is the oldest farm in America, were Indonesians, and they liked that work, and the family could come and do it. Or I met a young man from El Salvador who came after the troubles in that country and bought a farm in Lee, New Hampshire, where he could continue the agriculture that his family did in El Salvador, and he's brought them up here as well.
Well, let's pick up on that a little bit more. And I don't get from Ty that he's a refugee, but let's talk about that a little bit, Stu Wallace. How is the refugee story different from the sort of classic immigrant story that we've been talking about? And how is it the same?
Well, some of it's the same because of the language difficulties. I don't care what kind of an education you have. I had a student that I taught once who was a professional engineer in Bosnia. And he had a wonderful job in Bosnia and became a refugee. And he had to start all over again. His company, fortunately, was forward-thinking and required him to go back to school to learn the language and the culture. And they required him to take a course in New Hampshire history. But he had to start all over again at age 50, which was tough.
Wow. Yeah.
Asians, of course, are going to have a problem with language because their language is a more tonal language. In fact, we have more trouble with their language than they have with ours. And I was involved in placing refugees in the 1970s from Vietnam and Cambodia. And language was the biggest single issue they faced, and still is for Vietnamese, say, who have come over since. They struggle with the language, and that's a problem, refugee or not. But refugees often find themselves in a position where they've moved around a lot. Bosnians may have gone to Germany, then come here. This Ty's example is one who went from North Korea to South Korea to here. And he's done something that a lot of refugees and others do. He's turned to mathematics, the international language. I often have trouble with people in history because they have to read a lot of English, but they love accounting and statistics.
So you're not their favorite teacher.
So no, they love statistics because mathematics is the international language, and it helps them through that. But refugee is a problem, and it's been a problem since the Second World War when we started to open up the gates, when we started to recognize the fact that we had a a world in turmoil and that we needed to start taking in people from a variety of other countries.
So some similarities, cultural differences, language differences, mm-hmm. but seems to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Stu, that refugees, because they are placed here because of, you know, war and persecution and, you know, have often gone through horrible experiences,
camps
and so forth. You know, there's a lot of mental scarring and real emotional difficulty.
They've gone through that and they're often isolated here. I mean, you can go to parts of Manchester where there are blocks of houses that are strictly refugee housing. I remember going through one of those recently. I had to pick up my daughter after a so-called sleepover where they never sleep. And I didn't hear a word of English as I went up three flights to get to the refugee house. And so they are isolated to some degree in our own culture.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. Ty, thanks for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And from Hopkinton, Ingeborg is on the air. Hi, Ingeborg. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. This is a wonderful program covering a subject close to my heart because my parents in the 1920s came from Germany. My mother as a child with her family settling in New York and my father as a student that same year. He was studying at the university in Hamburg, and he asked his professor what he should do with all of this newfound knowledge, and he said, go to America. So my father did, and came to New York and finished up his graduate work and then was looking for a job and went to the employment agency at Columbia, and they said, you know, there's a school for boys up in a place called Concord, New Hampshire. And why don't you look into that? So it was a substitute job only, so he took the train up to Concord and worked there, worked at St. Paul's, and had no intention of staying because New York was just such a rich and exciting environment, but absolutely fell in love with the landscape of our state.
Now, Ingeborg, I'm interested, when exactly did they come from Germany?
Well, because in the 1920s. I think 1926. And so, my mother the same time, but as a child.
So after the First World War, but before the Second.
That's right. So he came up to Concord in, I would say, probably 1934, 35. And, you know, brought my mother up and my sibling, and we have been here ever since.
Well, it's great to hear from you. And, you know, David, I love this story because I've heard it from other people that my parents or myself came to America. Many people come to New York or Boston or Atlanta or whatever. And then somehow they end up in New Hampshire. We've heard these stories before.
Well, I think that a lot of immigrants think that maybe don't go to the place where it's already very crowded and you're just going to end up being in a ghetto in a large city, and that look for an economic opportunity where there are fewer of your group. I mean, think about what are called Arabs. In the census of 2010, 6,800 Arabs. Well, what does that mean? It means Syrians and Lebanese primarily who came over when the Ottoman Empire collapsed. And then some came to, you know, I went to Boston, I went to New York, but we got Sununus and Shaheens. And what a difference those two Arab families have made in New Hampshire politics.
So did they come to New Hampshire because they wanted the country over the city, because there were cultural reasons here, because we hear from some people that New Hampshire reminded me of home, you know, those people from sort of colder, hillier places. What do you think, David?
Well, I think that New Hampshire at that time offered in some of its small cities, you know, a small population already had a foothold. They might have had a Greek, you know, Maronite church or, you know, Lebanese church, and there'd be enough people to get a foothold there. But they move very quickly into entrepreneurial activities. They want to start the small businesses. And New Hampshire is a place you could do that without a lot of capital.
Well, and sometimes, Stu, it's totally random. I met a Iraqi refugee family a couple years ago, and I said, how did you end up in New Hampshire? And he said they'd been placed in Atlanta, Georgia, but they didn't feel safe there. So they got on Google Maps or something. And they looked at New Hampshire and they said, that looks pretty. And they got on the bus and, you know, took a 2-day bus ride up to New Hampshire. And here they are.
It can be random. It can be just the refugee service. It can be like Lutheran services place a lot of people, and they place them all over the place, not necessarily associated with their past. I helped a Vietnamese family and they were placed in North Branch, Minnesota. And I remember counseling them on what cold was really like. But that was a case where just the refugee service placed them, and the church there was willing to take refugees.
Well, and in later programs, we'll definitely be looking at the specific issues surrounding refugees. Let's take another call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Moel is up with us. Hi, Moel, calling in from New Boston. Go ahead.
Yeah, just to mention about refugees, some of them are like Iraqi or Congolese. We are kind of involving their life. We made them become refugees, and now they lost everything from their hometown, and they did not want even to be here because they are isolated. You know, Iraq, for instance, people who helped the soldiers during the war.
Right.
After the war, what happened? So they are kind of being enemies of their own because they helped U.S. America, and we invaded Iraq.
Noel, how long have you been here yourself?
5-6 years in and out, and I work with refugees, experts in their life in the camp, helping overseas and here. In Congo, we were involved in the diamond during the Cold War. We even helped to assassinate the President Lumumba. Since then, the 60s, now how many refugees are being killed? 6 million plus. And, you know, some are lucky to be here.
Moela, what do you think about, Moela, I'm sorry to interrupt you. What do you think about the idea that that has come up, and we'll talk about this in later shows, that New Hampshire's got enough refugees right now, there's not enough services available to help those who are already here, so could we cut off the flow for a while? This is a call that we're hearing from some, especially the mayor of Manchester, and I wonder what you think, Moel.
Yeah, I mean, there should be help. It's because it's not their fault to be here. We created it, so they should be taken care of. You know, because you cannot imagine how you live in a refugee camp 10 years or more, your kids being born there, no education, no food, it's not humane.
Right.
To be a refugee, and people don't know that.
Well, and Moel, we'll talk more about that as the series continues, but I do want to pick up on his points, Stu Wallace. It's, you know, as he says, incredibly difficult to come here.
It is.
Maybe even more difficult than your typical immigrant.
Oh, it is. You've got the language problems. You've got the fact you own nothing. You've got the fact that there may be stigma against you. All of this can work very much against you. And so that it is, if you talk to refugees today, they will tell you, well, we got a little help at the beginning, but now we're cast aside and it's almost impossible to find a job or anything else.
Well, Moel, thanks for joining us, and good luck to you and your work. You know, gentlemen, just a couple other themes that have come up as we look at this immigration story. And I say immigration writ large, immigrants and refugees. What do you think, David Waters, when we see a group status change from newcomer and outsider to established and insider, what types of changes are going on that makes that shift in status happen?
Well, it's often advances in the second and third generations in education, which means moving up into the middle class, home ownership, and the possibilities of owning a business. I think it also has something to do with the decline of the language spoken at home. It's only about 8% of New Hampshire residents in 2010 spoke a language other than English at home. The national average is about 18%. And so I think that because we have smaller populations sometimes and ones that have been here a long time, 307,000 people claim French heritage, that as the generations have gone by. I think also there's great forces of assimilation. Patriotism is one in our world wars, and also it can be work experience. You know, the unions brought people together in the Amiskeag, and also corporation housing. The corporations at Amiskeag and other factories provided were not segregated by ethnic groups. So these things, you know, brought people together, and time passes, and there's a real commitment to the kind of values that made America. I remember a photograph taken in 1916 of the famous Amiskeag American flag. The thing must have been 100 feet by 300 feet hanging up on the building there, and all the workers are standing out in front of it. Now, that's a statement of what was happening, you know, with World War I coming on, but it also says something about that process of work and economic and educational success.
So when immigrant groups start, you know, having their own churches, their own schools, their own newspapers, and getting involved in politics too, right? I mean, eventually you see Irish running for office, Franco-Americans running for office, and so forth. Polish, we've got Ray Wieczorek, a major figure in Manchester.
Well, we do, they do get more involved, and I think one of the things we need to focus on is the fact that the immigrants themselves see this as a second or third or fourth chance, really, and they throw themselves into it with great zeal. I remember a family I worked with where the father was embarrassed because after 2 years in the schools here, his children spoke perfect English and he didn't, and they learned well and went and did very well for themselves. I think that what happens to the immigrant, the story of the eventual breakdown of the stereotypes, the breakdown of the immigrant experience and the entry into the full-scale American life is by itself a great story. I taught a class once on the ethnic heritage of New Hampshire, and I thought I would have college students at UNH interested in the immigrant experience. Instead, I had an average age class of about 35. Many of them are immigrants or first or second generation immigrants from different cultures. And I can tell you, I learned a lot in that class. They were full of stories about how after World War II, the breakdown of the fact that they had taken up new jobs, new careers, new educational opportunities. And that's what immigration was supposed to be about. Whether we take quotes from George Washington to the present, the immigrant was supposed to bring their enrichment to our core culture.
Well, David Waters, we'll be looking at this again all week and pretty much all year. But what do you hope that we take away from this once it's all wrapped up?
Well, I hope we take away how much New Hampshire is an immigrant state and that what we experience here, triple-deckers, churches, neighborhood grocery stores, all the things we love about our New Hampshire urban environment, and particularly is actually an immigrant landscape, and that we really can think about ourselves as being a much larger story.
All right, and more coming up again in the weeks and months ahead. For more information, you can go to our website at nhpr.org. David Waters, thanks a lot for being here.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It's great.
And Stu Wallace, also good to see you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our series on New Hampshire's immigration story is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. Thanks again to our reader today, Mal Cameron. Our engineer is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, we continue our series on New Hampshire's immigration story with a look at the impact on our healthcare system. Language difficulties, financial barriers, and cultural misunderstandings can all contribute to problems when newcomers need healthcare for themselves and their children. We'll examine the issues that come up and what some are doing to resolve them. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and Sports Medicine Atlantic.